The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's Mad Tech Podcast. My name is Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by Jay Pulsara, Global Head of Digital at Reckitt Benckiser. Hello, Jay.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Pleasure is all ours. And I'm also pleased to be joined by a voice that you'll recognise, our wonderful CEO, Rachel Smith. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, AMS, and hello, Jay. You know, 2 weeks in a row, a lot of Rachel talking too much on podcasts, so I'm going to try and contain myself today.
Oh, well, it's been a while since I've had the pleasure of being on a podcast with you, so knock yourself out. Right, let's get into it. Our first story this week is accredited The Guardian, and the headline is CNN Plus to shut down after just 1 month. So many are probably aware that CNN Plus was established while CNN was still part of AT&T, had reportedly seen investment of up to $300 million, and now leaves around 500 employees in limbo. In a memo, the incoming CNN chief executive, Chris Litt, said the service would shut down at the end of April, so in the coming days, and some CNN Plus content will wind up on other company networks, and the streaming services employees will get opportunities to apply for jobs elsewhere inside Warner Brothers Discovery. What I'm keen to understand here is, Jay, I'm going to come to you in this. Do you feel, have linear broadcasters successfully capitalized on SVOD to date?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's a yes and a no. I think there's still opportunities out there that can be capitalized on. I think we've seen some linear broadcasters doing it very well. So like you mentioned, the Warner Discovery, the Disney's. But I still think there's opportunity for other linear broadcasters to maybe improve on it slightly. So a good example is actually Roku recently has launched some live linear channels. And we know it's a streaming app, but they're also moving back into that linear field as well. So I don't believe there's a yes or no answer to it. I think there's some that have done it very, very well. And we see that, and we can probably, over the last 2 weeks, we've seen in the news as well, how well they're doing it and the changes that's happening in the kind of SVOD space as well. But there's also opportunity. And I think that opportunity is areas such as content and who can actually drive the best content. Because I believe that there's different content that each provider will look to specialize in going forward as well. And that will create opportunities for an end user to not just choose one, but have multiple providers that they look to in terms of touch points from a media perspective.
I think you've raised an interesting point there around the content, because I believe some people were doubtful that a paid news channel would acquire subscriptions. And that, coupled with kind of ongoing exodus of consumers from premium SVOD services, has raised questions about the future of streaming platforms more broadly. Rachel, I'm keen to get your thoughts around this.
So it's interesting because we chatted about this a little bit on the podcast last week with respect to more traditional publishers, not broadcasters, and the way they monetize their content. And one of the points that we chatted about last week was that it's very difficult to charge people for news content that they can get elsewhere and for free, right? And I think that that's as applicable in a TV streaming environment as it is in a you know, online display content environment. So I think that's a massive challenge, and I think that's probably one of the things that has caused CNN to shut down this particular service, because even though it would have been an interesting experiment to see if they could continue to grow those subscriber numbers, because, okay, they weren't great, but they weren't terrible. If their ambition was 2 million in the first year and they managed to get something like 150,000 in the first 1 or 2 months, arguably, if they ramped it up and put more effort into it, they maybe could have got close to that target. But the point here is that it's quite an expensive experiment, I guess, and the doubt or the question mark in everyone's minds is, will people continue to pay to access news services that's carrying content that you can get elsewhere for free? And I think that was probably one of the big problems.
Jay, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I completely agree. I think like Rachel mentioned, it's not that CNN Plus failed. No one's saying it was a failed launch. It was in their eyes, it was actually successful and they backed a lot of money behind it.
Mm.
It's more the opportunity. Is news alone actually good enough to be a streaming service for or SVOD service? Actually, will we actually see the power of it grow and the viewership within that division of CNN Plus grow now that they're combined with Warner Discovery? And will we actually see that the viewerships and those users move over to that platform as well? And I think that's the most interesting point is, now that they've got a range of different content, are they actually going to grow their base better than they would have by just focusing on one piece of content alone? And like Rachel said, that one piece, that vertical that they were focusing on can be accessed anywhere else. You can get news content for free. Mm. So it'll be good to see what content you can't get anywhere else put on those platforms and see how that impacts the actual news viewership for live streaming.
That's the area to look at. Sorry, go ahead, Rachel.
No, I was just going to say that's a really good point, actually, Jay, as well, is that what they've now done is taken a step back from what was, you know, what could be seen externally. Who knows how it's stacked up internally is an expensive experiment. This gives them an opportunity to experiment a bit more with the way that they make content available and what that does to their viewership numbers. And, you know, I think the other thing that's quite interesting about this is it tells a little bit of a story of how cable broadcasters are trying to reorganize themselves and rearrange themselves, knowing that cord cutting is such a big trend, particularly over in the US where cable was an enormous trend and people are now moving away from those cable services and going towards more, you know, heading more towards streaming services. And so these traditionally cable broadcasters are trying to work out how they play in that space. And that's what I think is really interesting. And I think CNN are in a good position now, like you said, with the additional assets they've got in that family, you know, of ownership to play around with it, see where they're viewers are actually going and see where the really interesting pinch points are in the business and experiment a little bit more with how they can get eyeballs to the right content and then think in another 12 months' time how they can best introduce monetization models associated with that.
There's a few things there, right? Because, Jay, you talked about the range of content. There's a question around the quality of content. I know I read somewhere that there was questions around whether or not CNN Plus was a bit woolly, because in terms of the quality of the content, because CNN was contractually forbidden from live streaming its pay TV news. Yeah. So can CNN get breaking news onto a streaming service without violating its agreements? Nobody knows. The element about cord cutting there, Rachel, there were stats from Nielsen that only 18% of Americans have 4 streaming subscriptions, 10% have 5, and 7% have 6 or more. So the question is, who would have picked CNN Plus over a Netflix, a Hulu, a Disney Plus, a Prime Video, HBO Max, and Sling TV, and how many more if we're talking about the US in particular? So my question to you both, and Jay, I'm going to jump to you first, put you under pressure, is maybe should they have built an ad-supported service accessible to all people, regardless of their income, to help improve perhaps the quality of the output and the range of the content that they were putting out?
I think they could have, but would that have helped? Would have having an ad service help the quality of the content? Potentially not. Mm. I think it would have helped the financial aspect, and they probably would have made some more revenue from it. But I think it wouldn't have helped the actual quality of the content. I think you actually raised a very, very good point here, which is actually they weren't able to stream news live, and news should be like people want to see the news there and then. They want
but to like you said, you can get anywhere, right? So there's loyalty to CNN, but the quality of CNN breaking news, have they damaged their brand?
Yeah. I guess by being a bit outdated, and even if it's a couple of minutes or an hour in the past, I still feel like it probably did damage the brand, because there's also a terrestrial TV CNN channel that you can probably go on and get the news live there and then. So what was the differentiating factor? What was the USP for me to pay for this service when I could just go to the linear TV channel and get my update there in the moment?
Yeah, was that legal?
And I mean, also, I think that makes me think again about the quality of the content. I think if you were then covering that news, not at a breaking point, but at an hour later or whatever, then you're starting to compete with those really big heavyweight news channels that will that will break news, and then they'll also start then doing a special on it in an hour's time, because they've got the, you know, they've got the presenters for it, and they've got the researchers and the journalists for it, and they can smash that stuff out. Now, CNN are probably fully capable of doing that, but then where does that fall? That's sort of slightly more premium content. The other thing on the content piece, sorry guys, I know probably we're ready to
you
move
promised
on.
You weren't going to.
No, no. And here we are again. The last thing I wanted to say was, it's interesting to wonder how the numbers stack up, because it's all good and well coming up with an ad-supported option, but producing high-quality original content is really expensive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so many conversations happening in the marketing and advertising industry about that, right, with connection to Netflix and other streaming services.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see how it progresses from here. But you're right, we do have to move on. So I'm going to kick on to our second story, which is it's about a new report that claims Microsoft is working to build an in-game advertising network for free-to-play games on Xbox consoles. Now, apparently this is a program which will enable marketers to insert ads into free-to-play Xbox games. It's currently in the works at Microsoft, but according to the reports, the tech giant is developing a private marketplace that will restrict the ad opportunities available to brands and advertisements that won't interrupt the gameplay. Now, this is something that we've talked about a few times. There's been, you know, a few failures in this space where people have very much upset loyal and avid gamers. But apparently, they're in the process where they're just still deciding who to partner with on building the inventory catalog and organizing ad placements. But the marketplace could launch by Q3. That's phenomenal speed. So I would imagine that, you know, conversations are quite far down the line. But of course, Microsoft has neither confirmed nor denied the rumors, although the move could alienate members of the community, as I was talking about, because historically it's been less receptive to, they've been less receptive to advertisers in the space. You know, these are avid gamers in a place that they're focusing on something in particular. But the plus side is it could potentially provide a vital revenue to developers, meaning that they would not have to rely as much on in-app purchases or their players buying season passes. So there's a lot going on there. And I'm going to come to you, Rachel, just to kind of kick off the discussion around this, because there's more that we can delve into. But what are your thoughts around whether or not advertising in hardcore games will become the new normal?
And I say all of this from the point of view of being a very inexperienced gamer, but I think the answer to that question from my point of view is yes, it will become much more normal. Advertising in a gaming environment, a hardcore gaming environment, as well as a hyper-casual environment. When I read this story and then spent a little bit of time reflecting on it, it made me think that this is another one of those experiments with advertising that will be a bit of a test case, I suppose, for what advertising in the metaverse looks like. This is feels like a stepping stone towards that. So I get that Microsoft are saying they don't want the advertising experience to be intrusive and it's all going to be, you know, they don't want to interrupt gameplay. And, you know, we know that a lot of gamers have pushed back on advertising in a gaming environment in other contexts to date. But I think that the likes of Microsoft and their competitors, because Sony have also released news that they're intending to insert advertising in their in-game consoles. So I think that this will become more normal. And one of the reasons is not just because, you know, advertising makes money for these companies and it feels as though, like I said, it's perhaps a bit of a stepping stone to advertising in the metaverse. And why wouldn't these guys therefore be trying it in their gaming environments first? But I also think it's because most businesses that are dealing with any form of content and entertainment have to come up with a diversified revenue model. And as you mentioned in the intro there, AMS, you know, this is part and parcel of Microsoft wanting to find other ways to monetize and wanting to also be able to incentivize game developers to monetize outside of the channels that already exist. So I do think, from a very inexperienced gamer's point of view, I do think that this will become more normal. And I think, like I said, it's really interesting that Sony are setting up their plans almost in tandem with a very similar timeline as Microsoft. And I think we'll start seeing this more from gaming providers. And I mean, you know, those are two companies that are examples of enormous corporations that own both the hardware and the software. So we might start seeing this unfold with other gaming providers a bit differently. But yeah, I think it's going to become more commonplace.
Before I jump to you, Jay, and tell us, you know, how much budget or B are going to be piling into this, what I also read is that sources claim that Microsoft is not interested in the ad revenue that could result from such an endeavor, but rather its potential to eventually spin off into a full-blown Xbox ad network. Look at my surprised face. Now, Jay, over to you.
Sure. So I am quite a gamer.
Excellent.
Not at the
moment. Thank God. At least one of us is.
Not at the moment, because my wife is expecting literally any time soon. I have had to pack all my consoles away. But I see this as an opportunity, basically, because I think one of the things we need to clarify here is hardcore games. Like, what is a hardcore game? I think.
Good question. I wondered the same, but
when you said that investing in a console is takes it up a level straight away, surely, as opposed to me playing
on your mobile.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I guess if that's what we're classifying as a hardcore game, I would say there's an opportunity, because if we look at the top 10 publishers of last year, so yes, Microsoft and Sony make the actual hardware, but they were also the top two publishers of games last year as well. So they were also making the revenue from that side. Now, what that does is it means that the smaller publishers, the ones that are putting out their content and their games out there for free, they need a revenue model now, because they can't compete with the likes of Microsoft and Sony from a production point of view, from a financial point of view. And it means it gives them that layer of support. So I think there is an opportunity, especially if it's kept to F2P games, which is free-to-play games. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the opportunity is. Soon as it starts going into the paid game area, that's where there may be questions, because most of these games, when you're buying them brand new, especially Xbox and PlayStation, range between your £50 and your £60. Now, you probably, as an end user, you probably don't want your journey, your online gaming journey, to be disrupted if you've already paid that much.
Yeah.
But if we help them understand that actually for your free to play games, the more you kind of accept and understand why advertising is being put on there, I think that's where they will actually start, the end user will start understanding actually this gives smaller publishers the opportunity to survive as a company, the opportunity to grow and diversify their product and deliver that enjoyable experience when it comes to actually playing a game as well. And then additionally to that, I think we should also look at the article also said that they haven't really thought about like the formats and stuff that they're going to roll out there. Because if I stuck a banner ad in the middle of a game, then yeah, no one's going to like it. But there's certain periods in a game where the game may need to load. Now, the user's already waiting at that point and they're not really doing much. But if there's a if we can use that slot to do something like a gamification ad, actually play a mini game.
A game within a game, yeah.
And wouldn't that suit the context of the environment a bit more? So I think if it's done right, it can be done well and it can be the new normal for free-to-play games. I think for paid games, they'll need to be a bit more smart. So it'll be more on the product placement side, which is, I guess, to Rachel's point, more delving into the metaverse, which is going to be more, how do we actually place products there? How do we actually advertise in not as intrusive of a way as we may do on, say, mobile and display, and make it more part of that immersive experience?
But there are companies out there, there are ad tech companies that help with that integration already. Yeah. You know, it's kind of seamless in the billboard and the background when I'm playing a racing game. Typically go for a car game. I'm sure there's plenty of other games out there. But from a brand's perspective, the uplift doesn't seem to be kind of there as quickly or as much as we thought it would be. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but can you share any advice as a gamer and a brand marketer and head of digital, what do you kind of think the resistance is, especially if we look towards the metaverse, to make brand adverts and advertisers more comfortable in investing on this channel?
Yeah, sure. So I think because it's so new, there are certain areas that need to be clarified quite quickly, like how brand safe would we be being on that type of environment? How do we protect our brands from not actually advertising towards publishers that may not be responsible media publishers or those type of kind of publications? So I think it's more around the logistics of maybe every brand, yes, we probably do want to do it because we understand that the generation now is a kind of gaming generation. They do play on the mobiles. They play on these hardcore kind of platforms such as Xbox and PlayStation. So I think it's more about understanding if we were to jump in, what are the barriers to stop us from going wrong as well? What are the brand safety barriers? What should we be aware of as well? And what could potentially go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that you wouldn't necessarily want to be aligned with Grand Theft Auto when you're going in robbing places. But Cinet Bang could clean their car afterwards, you know? Yeah. That would be kind of appropriate.
There we are. AMS doing a pitch to get on the marketing team at RB.
And I'm thinking that is their brand, right? You've got so many.
Yeah, it is.
I've done my research. I'm sorry. I'd still be doing my research if I was going through your catalogue of products.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. I'm curious to know where audio will come into this as well, because it's not really talked about as much again, and how appropriate it would be in what environment. Rachel, do you have anything to add to what Jay said?
Well, really, it would be more questions from my side since Jay's the gamer amongst us. When you were chatting away there, Jay, about formats, one of the first things I was thinking of was, because, you know, both Microsoft and Sony are talking about wanting to introduce non-intrusive advertising. Mm-hmm. Is that possible? And what does that non-intrusive advertising look like? And you picked up on it a bit there when you're talking about formats, because, you know, formats are important to brands because they need to understand what they're going to look like and they need to be convinced that those formats aren't going to be intrusive. But, you know, does that exist? Are we talking about inventing some new formats? And then I guess that links a little bit to Anne-Marie's question just now, which is there a place for audio? And, you know, I haven't really thought about it very much, because if my gaming experience is purely hyper casual, and so you're talking about annoying advertising that you're trying to get rid of all of the time, wouldn't it be amazing to have a completely different advertising experience? And do we have the tools to make that possible? So I'm of no help at all. I do apologize, but I think Jay maybe has a bit more to say on that.
Yeah, so I think the tools are out there in the market, and I think in order for an organization as large as Microsoft and Xbox to say that they'll probably have something ready for Q3 means that the tools are out there. I think it's more about kind of testing. So there'll be a period of where they probably do go wrong at the start, and it will be that test and learn. How quickly can they learn off the failures that they may see at the start to kind of advance? So things like gamification ads are already out there. Things like incentivized ads, that's another big one, especially for gaming. Can we actually have our users getting more lives or more times on a level or something like that just by watching an ad? Because that means they're getting some value out of it, and so is the publisher. So I believe the technology is out there, and this is my opinion. I think it's more about forming that technology together and basically looking at what they would need to make it as less intrusive as possible and make sure that that user journey and that gaming journey stays how it should be, which is enjoying the content and the playing aspect.
Yeah. So improving the sophistication of the tools that we've got available as well, so you mentioned it before where you said, you know, particularly in free-to-play games, if we can get to a place where users understand why they're being served advertising, I've got no problem with that in a hyper-casual gaming environment at all. I just want the experience to be better. I just want it to be a bit more seamless and just a little bit more, you know, I don't know.
Would you give your data away for that?
Maybe. If I was really into a game, I might. I haven't to date, but then I'm not much of a gamer, you see. If I got hooked, I reckon I might. And then again, that comes down to how much, you know, sort of trust you've got with the brand, either with the game, you know, the brand that's associated with the game that you're providing, or with actual brand advertising that's happening in that environment. There's sort of so many potential hurdles to overcome, but I definitely believe we're in an environment where we're much more tolerant of those messages than we were even 12 months ago, 18 months ago. And then it's also different from sort of, you know, depending on where you're located. I just think if we go back to our first story when we're talking about a TV environment, I think that in general in the US people are much more ad tolerant because they're used to seeing a whole pile of advertising in that environment. We're less ad tolerant here, but that's changing. We're just, I think, you know, we're I think, and I also think, sorry, now I'm doing too much talking again. If we think about what's driving all of this, which is how do we monetize these products, pardon me, whether that's gaming or whether that's content that we're consuming in a TV environment or, for that matter, in a display digital environment, people are becoming much more aware of the value exchange there between, you know, what pays for that, how do we pay for the people that provide that to us, and, you know, what must we, you know, exchange in order for that to happen?
That's a really good question, which will bring us on to our third story, because that is about a story that I'm sure hasn't gone past anyone, about Netflix announcing plans for an ad-supported tier amidst tumbling subscriber numbers. I'm gasping because we've talked about this so much in Exchange Wire, and I'm sure other you have as well. You know, how long can this go on? But just to kind of summarize for our listeners, Netflix has done a U-turn on its long-held rejection of advertising. Executives of the streaming giant revealed last week that they now plan to introduce an ad-supported subscription tier to the platform after it saw a staggering 200,000 subscribers leave the platform in the first 3 months of 2022. Again, listeners, I've got my massive surprise face on right now. So what, you know, what else is going to incite action other than the stock market value plummeting by $50 billion? I mean, that will wake anybody up. But what we need to think about is it in response to the cost of living crisis? Many consumers have cancelled their streaming services. We talked about the stats from Nielsen earlier on when we were looking at CNN Plus, etc. For many, pulling the plug on Netflix doesn't appear to have been a particularly painful sacrifice, which... as a subscriber, that doesn't surprise me either, because I kind of look at the quality of the content that's been coming out, what their output is, and the higher price tags, depending on what region you're in. And on top of making the ad offering available in the next 2 years, the company's trying to curb the impact of its subscriber loss by cracking down on password sharing and pledging to reduce spend on content. I mean, who would share their login details with their friends? That's outrageous. Anyway, what I'm going to come back to you, Jay, first here and say, you know, was Netflix wrong to resist ads for so long?
I think at the time of their launch, probably no, because they were the only ones around. And I think when people were paying for premium service, we got to think of the mind frame of the end users at the time. It was a new service for them. It was the end of the blockbuster era, and it was the start of like that Netflix era. So at the time when they were switching over, they were used to not seeing ads when they pay for stuff like movies, etc. I think now when we look back, potentially when they were the only ones around, there probably was an opportunity then to actually place ads and learn across the way on which ads actually work better for them, which in turn would by now would have helped them build a model that could potentially be working for them from an ad income perspective. But I don't think advertising for them is going to solve everything. I think content, like you said, they're going to stop investing as much into content. Now, we've already seen Disney's taken most of the Marvel and those type of content out of Netflix. So I believe for them, the focus should be on content more than advertising, because if you don't have the right content there, you probably won't attract any brands there as well, because they'll know most of your users have moved away. And once someone moves away, it's a lot harder to then bring them back as well. So I think you mentioned they've lost 200,000, but I think they're forecasted for another 2 million this quarter to something like that. So they are losing revenue. And I think they're now in a moment of kind of panic to say, what do we do now? Is it that we charge people to share passwords, which has also been discussed? Is it that actually we're going to start advertising? But I think, was it wrong to dismiss them at the time? Or was it wrong to say they should have done advertising? No, because I think at the time they were the only ones around, and they built quite a successful streaming model that other people have piggybacked and kind of replicated. And I think that's where they may have kind of fallen back, is that they haven't advanced along that same sphere as the other kind of linear broadcasters may have as well.
Yeah, that's true. Rachel, what would you like to add?
I think Jay's provided a really comprehensive summary there. And so what can I add here? Maybe this is an example of kind of go first and do all the mistakes and then other people get to learn from you.
Yeah.
I think your point about them having an opportunity to introduce advertising much earlier on in the piece is really interesting. And because I think that much earlier on in the piece was probably really quite early on in the piece,
yeah,
maybe earlier than we all started debating whether they would or not, because you've also reminded me that they were market leaders, you know, a long time ago. I mean, I was a Netflix customer when it used to be Love Films. So,
yeah,
you know, they had such an opportunity in the early days of building this company to think about diversifying their model. It was really interesting for us to all be part of that experiment. Wow, you know, paying for premium content, not paying a huge amount for premium content, and just being able to consume as much as you want and not having to deal with advertising. Wow, this is amazing. But I think that's what made everybody, particularly that works in marketing and advertising, think as soon as you started to feel like that, I think everybody started to think, it's too good to be true. This can't possibly last. I think the only other thing I can add is, you know, I was doing a little bit of listening of other industry podcasts this week, and I came across Brian Weezer from Group M's weekly podcast. He does a really good This Week, Next Week summary with one of his colleagues at Group M. He always discusses things from a financial point of view. His session this week was hilarious because he talked about how he'd been contacted by an outrageous number of colleagues across the industry, basically wanted to say to him, I told you so, because he'd always been a big advocate of the Netflix subscriber model and had said he didn't think while Reed Hastings was running the company that they were ever going to move to an ad supported model. And he really, and so he said, okay, you know, he apparently said if ever he was proven wrong, he'd eat his mask. And so he said, here I am eating my mask. He managed to get an edible chocolate version of it. It's all very entertaining. But he also gave some reasons behind his thinking at the time. And it was actually all financial from what I could tell. And Brian is a financial analyst. So of course, you know, listen to the podcast, guys, if you want to understand the detail. But effectively what he said was the way Netflix had built their model, it depended on financing in a certain way that didn't rely on advertising income at the time. And he felt as though in order for them to continue growing their subscribers, they went back to the bonds market and they got a little bit more financing and they managed to get to a cash flow positive position. He felt that that was a sustainable position for a lot longer than evidently they feel it is. So, you know, it's interesting. I have to agree with Jay. I reckon they could have experimented with the idea of an ad funded model much earlier, and that would have saved them some headaches that they're going to go through now. But I think by and large, we still all now get to sit back and wait to see what happens. And I think if you're Disney, Disney Plus, and if you're other successful streaming service, I think you're probably at the moment going, oh, thank God we weren't the first ones out the gate. This is great, because we've got a couple of tools at our disposal here. And at the moment, if you're sitting in Netflix, I think you're probably doing a bit of nail biting. On the content piece, I completely agree. You know, we've chatted about it. We chat about it a lot in the office here, that actually I'm not sure about the quality of Netflix's content. You know, they definitely smash out some good things, but can they afford to keep investing in those? Because they're not the only buyers on the market now. So we're seeing Hollywood actors making exclusive series, not just for Netflix now. So that's an expensive game to be in, really expensive game to be in.
I think it's also interesting on like the content delivery side of things. So will they stop actually putting their whole season up in one go versus like your Disney's that do one at a time, that helps you kind of retain that viewership week on week? And will we actually see when, say, Stranger Things new season is up, that they'll have a high influx of signups? And then once they've kind of ingested the whole season, will they go away?
Exactly. Pay as you go, right? And then therefore, will they invent a pay as you go model maybe and try to retain people for that short period of time? And also, will they deliver those series in a time lapse way, because maybe that's more impactful for advertisers, right? So there's a lot of options they could play around with there.
I saw it was interesting as well. Reed Hastings, as you mentioned, Richard, the chairman and co-chief exec, he said that it's likely that they're going to outsource the necessary ad technology functions. So this is on an earnings call, that it would be open door to have other people do all of the fancy ad matching and integrate all the data about people. And I mean, it sounds a bit blasé, you know, those people that know what they do, they can do it. We'll just pay them for it. But at what price will that come at? Because it's likely if they go down that route, you know, are they going to start with a high price point for advertisers? Will they achieve that? Will they be able to kind of hold their nerve? Because if, you know, if you're a media buyer, how risk adverse are you going to be, or how are you going to advise your clients? Because, you know, rates typically fall as services grow, right? And if you're, you know, I'm curious to know from a brand's perspective, what would you look at to, you know, what are the kind of triggers or the indicators that will help inform your decision as to which environment you're going to be in this occasion on a Netflix example?
Yeah, sure. So I think it would be things like viewership numbers, like which kind of shows have the highest viewership. And from what I see, as it will be quite similar to the way TV is bought as well. So where can we get the best reach? What are the highest viewerships? What is the most safest content as well to kind of advertise? Because I'm guessing on Netflix, not every brand is going to want to advertise across all content. There'll have to be kind of brand safe content, non-brand safe content, content categorized by like age and demographic to make sure it's child safe and things like that. So I think that's the areas that we would look into as an organization and as a brand to say, actually, have they got all of these bits in place in order for us to actually look at the opportunity a bit more?
Because on that point, actually, just to dig a little bit deeper, one of the things that they have in their favor is the amount of data that they have at their fingertips, right? But what have we as subscribers opted into? And what will change if I'm changing, if the business model's changing, if they're reducing the cost of my subscription in exchange for a part ad funded model, for example? But how are they going to do that? And what are those changes going to mean from a privacy and regulation standpoint? And therefore, how's that going to affect the decision process for you? It makes it quite complicated. So you're busy. So it'll probably go further down the priority list, right? Because you'll look to the path of least resistance where you can get those metrics and you know it's brand safe and you know it's transparent, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think you raise a really good point there, which is on the consent piece. If Netflix never had an advertising model in the past, have they actually asked for consent from all of these users to be able to use that login data? Because if they haven't, then what, once they, that consent piece goes out, what would the actual numbers be where we can actually use the first party or second party data they have? I think that's a very, very important piece that we need to actually consider, is how many of their users are actually going to consent to having their data used in that way.
Go on, Rachel.
I was just going to add to that, and then think about the complexities of running and managing that if you're, and you know, you're working for Netflix, and then you're trying to balance that against whatever ad tech providers you're working with who are delivering your advertising. And then how long before you go, Jesus, this is a massive operation and we need to control so many elements of it. Do you think maybe we should think about buying some ad tech? You know, I just
exactly.
It's really interesting to you know, fantasize about what might happen next.
But then you throw in TV-based commerce on top of that. That's an opportunity, but another complication.
Yeah.
Because if I think about it from a user experience, they've got my debit card or credit card details at hand. It could, in principle, be really easy for me if with a click of a button, a bit like Amazon Prime or whatever, one click buy, brilliant. Mm-hmm. But have they got my consent? No. Yeah. How are they going to go about doing that? The questions I'll be asking, the risk of fraud. And yeah, it's just a whole can of worms. But unfortunately, we don't have time to go into that right now. But what I would like to do is go to the second part. And the second part of the podcast, Jay, is finding out about what you're up to on your daily job and what your areas of focus are.
Yeah, sure. So I am in charge of leading the kind of internal planning and buying department for Reckitt globally. So my focus for the year is kind of to build additional capabilities. How do we actually do more as a team internally? How do we kind of link better to our brand objectives and use all of these digital touch points to kind of reach the end user in a non-intrusive way? So we want to kind of help that journey. We want to guide that journey for our brands. And we want to make sure that we're always embedding our brand purpose to those users as well. So that is my focus for the year. The team is constantly growing, so there's a lot of recruitment at the moment, which is great. But additionally, like, I think some of these subjects are going to be great to look into, like the Netflix advertising aspect. I will definitely be doing a deeper dive into that going forward to see if there's an opportunity. Same with the Microsoft Ads aspect as well. So I think there's a lot more coming out in terms of media touch points now as well. So like, it's no longer that we only get the consumer on their laptop, on their mobile or on the TV. There's actually the metaverse. There's all these different ways to connect with a consumer now, which is amazing. And I think it's so interesting in the technology you can use to kind of connect with them as well.
What's keeping you awake at night at the moment?
My wife.
Very exciting.
No, I think from a work perspective, it's more, or from a Reckitt perspective, it's more kind of what's next. I think our industry is so, like, it's advancing so quickly recently, especially during these last 2 years of COVID, where my impression was that there was going to be maybe a standstill where we wouldn't advance as quick because there's not as many people going into the office, etc. But actually, we've continued on our kind of trajectory, and we see the media landscape changing, and we've seen the digital landscape and everything coming together. So I think that's what I would say keeps me up at night, is because it's not a threat. It's more the opportunity out there. And what more can we do with this opportunity as well?
How do you balance the day job in terms of, you know, the delivery and managing the team and you're growing with taking the time out to explore? You mentioned you're going to dig deeper into these, but in reality, how do you kind of carve out that time, and what would make your life easier in terms of consuming information, what information you'd like to help you along that decision-making process?
Yeah, sure. So I do multiple things. I kind of try to stick some time in my diary to meet all of these new kind of technology providers and vendors, just to see what they're offering and how it could be beneficial for Reckitt. But we also have forums. So within my team, we have weekly forums where we give each team member like a specific project to lead or a vendor to kind of go and research, and they will come back and present. Because I think, as we're all aware on this call and all the listeners are aware, our ecosystem is very big. And a lot of players in there. It is impossible for one person to speak to everyone. But I think if you split it out and you find some of the key kind of vendors and technology partners, et cetera, that can provide some value, you can actually split those out between a team to actually do a deeper dive and learn a bit more on them as well, and bring that, if there's a business case and any impact that can be made, bring that back to Reckitt.
Wow. No rest for the wicked. Not that you're wicked.
That's fine. You could call me the wicked.
Oh, the wicked. Sorry.
Do you find, Jay, then, because it's really interesting to hear you describing, you know, the way that the sort of advertising and marketing landscape is changing is exciting, which is great. Like, you know, as in there's lots of opportunity out there, and your main focus is how can we harness that potential opportunity. Do you therefore find yourself being, you know, a bit brave and experimental at times? And are you experimenting across different channels, and are you discovering some surprising things?
Yeah, I think we basically plan our campaigns based on what the brand objective and the brief should be. So if we think actually there's a channel out there that could potentially perform better than another channel, then we will definitely look into that, and we'll look to plan that and run activity against that. Now, where I think it's very exciting now is that, and it seems that we are now taking, or I say we, but it seems like the industry is now taking this consumer-first approach. So it's no longer actually let's just pile loads of ads out there and hope for the best. It's actually let's take a step back. Let's think about what is it that the consumer would want, and actually starting to look at the journey of the consumer. How do they consume the media? How do they get to the end point? And how can we actually fit a journey in, an advertising journey in towards that consumer, so that one, they think of us as a positive brand and they have positive a positive kind of feeling towards us. But two, we haven't kind of negatively impacted their day to day. We've actually, they've got to the content they want to read, but they've also had maybe a content specific ad right there on that piece of content as well. So I think that's what the most exciting bit is at the moment, is actually the whole industry is thinking consumer first rather than advertising first, which it was a couple of years back.
Yeah, it's a massive shift, right? And it's what we spend our days talking about pretty much. Yeah.
Well, on that note, sadly, we've run out of time because I think both Rachel and I would love to continue talking to you, Jay, but based on what you just told us, what you're up to, we need to let you get back to the day job. So thank you for taking the time out to have a chat with us. It's really, really interesting.
Perfect. Thank you for the opportunity as well. And it was great speaking to you and reviewing the articles as well and giving my point of view.
Oh, thank you. And Rachel, of course, thank you as always.
Not at all. My pleasure. And thank you very much, Jay, not least of all for being our gaming expert. Phew.
Yes. And before we wrap up, I just want to wish you and your wife all the very best for the new arrival and keep us updated. And next time, you know, when you're on here, there might be, you know, a little person
on your lap. I'll have him strapped up right here.
Learning the tools of
with
the trade.
Branded.
Yeah, branded. Yeah.
Nice. Excellent. Thank you so much. Well, listeners, that's it for this week's Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you for listening and we'll be back again next week.